Well, in the back seat, you probably can't hear me. Anyway, I'm Roman. I'm going to talk about Project Lilliput. What it's about, a little bit of the history, and what we are trying to do. So what is Lilliput all about? It's mostly about reducing the memory footprint of Java applications. And specifically, it's about how we are trying to do this is by reducing the size of object headers in the Java VM from currently 12 bytes down to 4 bytes. As you probably know, in typical Java applications, you have like tens or hundreds of thousands of objects, and objects tend to be relatively small in many workloads. So this adds up to typically about 20 to 30% reduction in heap usage. Your mileage may vary. If you do the math, currently the minimum size of an object in the hotspot VM is 16 bytes. If we reduce that to like 4 bytes, this doesn't really happen because we have object alignment of 8 bytes. So the minimum object size would be 8 bytes with that. So the maximum savings that you can get out of this is like 50%. The minimum savings would be close to zero. If we have a heap full of really huge arrays or something like this, then you would have no savings. Most workloads tend to be in the middle of this, around 20 to 30% heap reductions. We can see that in, I run a let's say a well-known benchmark that simulates a web shop. Hey, it simulates Amazon. and I've run a steady workload on it and measured the heap size after periodic full GCs. And with the current JVM, we get around like almost 1,200 megabytes of heap usage after GC. With Lilliput, we get much less. It's around 900. It's about 22% savings in heap usage. And saving heap memory is the primary effect of this. There's also secondary effects because this lowers the pressure on GC, this improves cache locality, and so on. So this often also results in improved performance. In this same workload, we have this benchmark produces a latency measure and a throughput measure. So the left two bars are the throughput measure with baseline, current JVM, and Lilliput. This means that with Lilliput we get about 8% improved performance in this particular workload. The right-hand bars, the two bars on the right-hand side, this is the latency measure, the critical jobs. This improved even more by about 11 to 12%. How did that start? So this is a bit of a rundown of the history of Lilliput. It started all back in 2020, I believe, at FOSDEM. I was just talking about a new change that I implemented in the Shenandoah GC. Back then, the Shenandoah GC used to require an extra word per object to store the forwarding pointer. And at this FOSDEM, I talked about a big change where I removed this requirement. I removed this whole word per object requirement there. And I had a chat with Andrew Haley, where is he, in a taxi, I believe. And he said, hey, that's great, but couldn't we do this for all the GCs? Couldn't we do this for the whole runtime? Because we use like 16 bytes of memory for each object header, but other JVMs like GCJ, they only use 8 bytes. So why don't we do this in Hotspot JVM? And, well, how hard can it be? Right? It's good that nobody tells you how hard this can be. You would never start projects like this if you know how hard this would be in the end, right? So this is how it started at FOSDEM 5 years ago. It took another year to actually start it because I had other things to do and more work to do on Shenandoah. So the first commit happened in March 2021. We did lots of prototyping. Thomas Stüfel started to work on class pointer improvements. He will give a talk later about those improvements and how we did this for Lilliput. So I don't want to talk about this here. In 2022, we realized after a bit of prototyping that the way that synchronization works in Hotspot JVM doesn't really fit with what we want to do in Lilliput. That is because synchronization, so this is what happens when you do a synchronize statement and threads need to synchronize up. This was very racy on the object header because it's changing the lock bits in the object header concurrently, basically, with the running application. And this didn't really work well with Lilliput. So we decided to change this the way the locking works in the Hotspot JVM. And this is, again, a case of how hard can it be? as a kind of funny side story, there used to be a file in this code where it says at the top, do not ever tote unless you really know what you're doing. And even then, don't touch it. And we basically ripped it out and replaced it with something new. So this took a whole year. So the prototype was quite quick, one month of work to get something working. And then it took a whole year to get the PR reviewed and reviewed and reviewed again and change things and file another PR. And it was probably like 600 review comments and a lot of work on the side of Oracle and others to test it and review it. And we finally finished it in May 2023, and it went into JDK 21. Even then, it wasn't really finished because we also realized that the first implementation did not support recursive locking, and we realized that some workloads, this is quite important for performance, so Axel from Oracle implemented recursive locking in this new stack. This went in JDK 23, and this new lightweight locking became the default locking mode in JDK 23, so this was good progress. Even then, it was not really finished because there was still, this was only the lightweight locking side. There's also the kind of heavyweight locking that uses monitors, and this still uses the object header to for some purposes, and that kind of worked, but we wanted that to go away. So Axel and other folks at Oracle implemented the new object monitor table, and this went in August 2024. So 2023, what happened? We finished lightweight locking. We first proposed the version of the JEP 450 for Project Lilliput. This is what we call Lilliput 1. In 2024, the recursive lightweight locking and object monitor table landed, and we finally integrated the first JEP for this project into JDK 24, which is about to ship in March. 2025, this is where we are now. We are prototyping what we call Lilliput 2, which is the actual 4-byte headers. And later this year, we get the EA for JDK 24, where we ship the Lilliput 1, basically. So what's in it? So the current state of object layout in Hotspot looks like more or less like this. So we have a header at the top, which is, so each of those rectangles here is one word, which means 8 bytes, right? So the first one, word of each object is what we call the object header or mark word for some. Then we have a class pointer, which is which identifies which kind of class the object has. It's useful for things like virtual cores and et cetera, et cetera. And then starts the field or the array element. For arrays, we also store the array length in this 32-bit block there. And then we have the array elements. We want to, so for Lilliput 1, this is what is going into JDK 24. We improved this to only take 8 bytes per object. So we merge the class pointer into the object header, so we only have the single header here. For arrays, we still have the array length, but it's, shifts up a little bit and makes some free space, which we can use for the array elements. And the long-term plan is to reduce that to, well, long-term means like a couple of more releases, to reduce the header to just 4 bytes, make some more room there for actual fields or to store the array array length on the other side. Let's look at the details. So what is really in this object header? So this one, the upper schema here is showing what is in those bits in the object header. So we have two lock bits here, which is used for locking, as the name implies. There's an unused bit here. There's GCH. This is where we track the age of an object. This is 4 bytes. Then we have another unused bit here. We have 31 bits that is used for the identity hash code. And then we have some more unused bits here. And in the second word I showed you in the slide earlier, we have a compressed class pointer, which takes 32 bits. One of the main insights of Project Lilliput is that most objects never get identity hash code, and most objects never get locked. So this is really a tiny percentage of objects that are usually locked at all. So we try not to push the burden for these features on every object, and instead let only those objects that really need it pay for it. There's another little twist. When the object is locked, or when the object is GC forwarded, which I will get to later, this whole header is replaced by a pointer into native memory, which basically points to the lock object or the stack location where the monitor is. And this is the reason why we couldn't deal with lightweight locking so well. So for Lilliput 1, we want to change this, and you have seen all those unused bits, so we make use of those unused bits. We pack this a little bit better. We still have the lock bits. We have a bit that indicates self-forwarding, which is such a detail. Still, we have the object age here. We reserve 4 bits for the project Valhalla, because those guys told us, well, we are probably going to need those 4 bits. So we have those bits here. We still have the hash code bits here, and we have a compressed class pointer in the upper 22 bits. For Lilliput 2, the plan is, or the current implementation is, that we pack this even better. We only want to have 2 lock bits, still the self-forwarding bits. Those bits are all the same. We only have 2 bits to support the identity hash code, and then we have an even smaller compressed class pointer up there, and only 19 bits. So how are we doing this? Thomas is going to talk about the class pointer bits. I want to talk a little bit about the identity hash code. So how do we get from 31 bits for the identity hash code down to just 2 bits for the identity hash code? Just as a quick recap, what this is doing. So the identity hash code, the contract is, if 2 objects are the same object, then the identity hash code for one and the other reference must also be the same. And this is about object identity, not about object equals. So this is important distinction, but identity hash code is used as a default implementation for object equals, so this is used more often than you probably think. The inverse is not necessarily true, so if the identity hash code is different, doesn't mean that the objects must couldn't be, sorry, the inverse is not true. Anyway, and the identity hash code must remain stable throughout the object lifetime, which is an important property. It must not change. We want to shoot for great entropy, and yeah, as I said, it's the default implementation for object identity hash code. So the current situation is how it's implemented is we have 31 bits in every object that is reserved for storing the object the identity hash code. The first call to system identity hash code generates basically a random number and stores it there. And whenever this identity hash code is called again, we read that number that we just stored there and then return it. How can we avoid using those 31 bits? So the first naive idea is to always calculate a hash code that is based on the object address. The problem with that is that GCs can move the object around, so the address is changing. This violates one of the important properties that the identity hash code must stay the same. The other idea, allocate a slot for the identity hash code on demand, only when we need it. The problem is that usually the heap is filled contiguously, which means there's no space to do this. So how can we solve this? We basically combine the two ideas, and I get to this in a second. I first want to describe what those bits are doing. So we only have two bits now, and the meaning of those bits is the first bit says the object has been hashed or not hashed, or the other way around, and the second bit says the object is expanded or not expanded. And from there we basically have three states that we are using. We are going from the first state, the object is not hashed and not expanded. This is the default when an object is freshly allocated. The first time we call system identity hash code, this state transitions to the second one, the hashed not expanded state, which means we calculate the identity hash code based on the address. As long as the object does not move, we keep doing this. So if we subsequent calls, the identity hash code will recalculate the identity hash code based on the object address. So what happens as soon as the GC moves the object around and it observes an object that is in this particular state, it recalculates the identity hash code once again based on the original object address. Then it copies the object, allocates an extra slot for storing the identity hash code, sticks the identity hash code there, and then every subsequent call for identity hash code will return the hash code that we just stored there. And we move the state to this hashed and expanded state, so we know what we are doing. And as soon as we are in this state, every subsequent call would simply read this identity hash code slot. Where do we store this? The field layouter of the hotspot class loader can figure out a good place to do it. Sometimes there are gaps in the field layout and we can use those gaps. Sometimes there is an alignment gap at the end of an object. We can use this alignment gap. And if there's no gaps available, then we attach it at the end of the object and allocate an extra slot, basically. So often we don't even need to extend the object for real. We can reuse some free space that is there. So this is the result of this is we only require two bits per object. We allocate the space only when we really need it. As I said, majority of objects never need any identity hash code, so we save a lot of bits here. Question is, do I have enough time? I will quickly go over the other one. Need to make this quick. GC forwarding. Current situation is when a GC needs to copy an object, then we need to store the new location somewhere. And this happens by storing in the header itself. We flip those bits here to say 1-1, which means there's a forwarding pointer and all the rest of the header would be interpreted as a pointer into the new location of the object. There are two cases. One is copying compaction, the other one is sliding compaction. Copying compaction is relatively easy because we copied the object to a fresh region that is basically empty, and we retain the old copy as long as we need it for updating the references, which means the problem is that as soon as we store the forwarding pointer here, it overrides the class pointer information that we have here, and this class pointer information is crucial for operation of GC. So it's still quite easy because we just copy the object and we can find the class pointer here. And this is relatively easy to solve. You need to be careful, but it's not such a big deal. So this is how it works. I skip this because I'm out of time. As I said, it's relatively easy to implement because we have a copy of the object and there's no problem with reading the class pointer from the new copy. Sliding compaction is a bit more tricky because what sliding compaction does, it doesn't copy the object to a new empty space. It basically, if you imagine the heap as a big like stack of objects, it throws out all the unused dead object here and it slides all the live objects to the bottom of the heap. And the way it does is it first finds all the live objects in the marking phase. In the second phase, it calculates the forwarding addresses for each of the objects, and it stores those addresses in the object headers, at which point we would lose the class pointer information, and then updates all the references and then copies the objects to the new location, basically sliding them down. And we must not lose the class pointer information. This is the really difficult part here. But we also don't have a copy from which we could read this class pointer information. And we only have 9 bits here for actually storing the forwarding pointer information. So what can we do? The idea is that those 9 bits in the object header that we have is enough to address a 512 words of range in the heap, which is kind of 2048 bytes, 2 kilobytes, or 4 kilobytes even. So the idea is let's divide the heap into blocks of 412 words each and then use a side table with one entry for each block, and each entry basically stores the forwarding address for objects in that block, and then we can use those 9 bits in the header to find the forwarding address for the object. So the basically means look at the block in which this object resides, find the forwarding base of that block, add the bits that we have shifted by 3, and then you get the forwarding address. So this is a kind of a forwarding table, but it has the advantage that it has a fixed size. It's basically a fixed size, 1/512 of the heap size. It's not really that big. We have basically no performance loss using this approach. We have a potential to reduce the size even more by using the bits a bit more efficiently, or by extending the block size by 1 bit or so, and eliminates the 8 terabyte limit of Lilliput 1. So this is the advantages. I need to make it short because I'm running out of time. Putting it all together, we have tiny class pointers, which Thomas is going to talk about, with compact identity hash code, improved forwarding table, and we still have 4 bits that is basically currently unused but will be used by Valhalla, which is great. And the best thing about all of this is that you can basically forget it, because you don't need to remember all this. You only need to enable this feature by using this flag, and you will get memory savings for free. In the future, we intend to make this, hopefully make this the default and one and only header layout in Hotspot JVM. And that's it. Do we have time for questions?
Do you have any questions? Can you just repeat the questions?
Yes. Question. So the question was, if all objects use an identity hash code, do we use more memory, or what was? Oh, the performance. Okay. I did some experiments. I could not see any performance degradation. I did experiments similar to what you are describing, right? We haven't done the full experiment yet, so I expect that as long as the object doesn't move, we are recalculating the object identity hash code, and we believe that we expect this to be much even a bit faster than reading the identity hash code from memory, because memory access can, depending on if it's in the L1 cache or if it's in the RAM, right, you can have a lot of cycles just to get this stuff into the L1 cache. The identity hash code calculation is really designed to be very fast, so this should not take many cycles. Yes?
Depending on the identity hash code, it's just occurring to me, I like the way you can drop it into gaps.
Yeah.
Can you, first question, can you split that into
the question was, if we have gaps in the layout and we have smaller gaps that are smaller than 32 bits, can we split the identity hash code? No, we currently don't do this. Right.
Could you arrange your original calculation into 24-bit hash code, and that's the gap you'll use later as a cheat?
Yeah, that would be. I guess it would be possible. I guess adding the complexity or making this decision is probably more expensive than.
I did.
Yeah. So. I know.
So I've got a simple question here. So you've got this 4-byte thing.
Yeah.
4-byte line.
Yeah. There could be a field, like an in field or something.
So if you want a field that's like typically fields of references, right? So they're typically 8 bytes.
No, they're typically 4 bytes.
They're 4 bytes.
Yeah, unless you are, with compressed OOPs, you have 4-byte references. So this typically fits in there.
But if you don't have compressed OOPs, you have.
Then you have 8 bytes, and then there might be a gap there, right there.
So you have an alignment gap. So you're
exactly.
Gaining,
yeah.
Two or whatever.
Correct. Okay. Any more questions? No? Thank you.